You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1988 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is an evening lecture given by Brother Randy Tyra titled, The Times of Refreshing.
Someone once said that life is what happens to you while you're busy doing other things. I've heard that many years ago, and I always thought it was supposed to be amusing, but yesterday, I noticed something very unusual. I'm the same age as Brother Fred Wolf. We were baptized both in 1970. And it was astonishing for me to realize that we're the same age. I stood up and looked back, and the odd thing is that I've gone through so much in that 18-year period of time. I've been a very busy man. I've lived a lot of places. I've been a missionary, and I've done a lot of domestic missionary work, and I've lived on the East Coast and the West Coast and the North and the South. I've done a lot of things during that entire period of time. And when I look back to my childhood, the last place I would have assumed that I would be as an adult would be here amongst you. While I was busy doing all of these things, something was guiding my life. Something was directing me. And many of the people gathered here this evening were part of that. I owe a great debt to many of you. You've shaped my life. You've helped to make me what I am, be that as it may. And I do owe you a debt of gratitude. I am grateful. Secondarily, you may have been rather astonished at the reading. It was not, oh, look at what we have up there. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads. For your redemption draweth nigh. Now, the reading was tragic. It was ugly. Full of desolation. Full of woe and despair. But there is a tremendous similarity, actually, between the time of that reading, out of Lamentations, and the time that's spoken of by that. Jeremiah most certainly wrote the Lamentations between 587 and 585 B.C. Just after the destruction of the temple. The taking away of all the nobility and the great men of the nation of Judah. If there was ever a greater army than Nebuchadnezzar's in the world, it was the army of the Romans that sacked Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Nebuchadnezzar was not as cruel as the Assyrians, but he was a very efficient killer. He was very, very good at what he did. There was good reason for him to be the head of gold in Daniel's image. He was the greatest power the world had seen until that time. And yet in the midst of that chaos, in the midst of the disaster that existed around those people at that time, Jeremiah looked up and he said, I have hope because I know that my God's compassion will not fail. And I know of a surety that this exile will not continue forever. In 70 years, we'll be back. The same thing with that. When Jesus spoke those words, his disciples knew that it would not continue forever, the exile that was to come. It lasted a little longer than 70 years. It lasted 19 centuries. But they knew that the Gentile times would come to an end. And when those times came to an end, they would go home. And so they had hope. They had confidence. They had the assurance that someday they would stand again on Mount Zion. You look 2,000 years into the future. You're very near to our time. And there was another great time of chaos, another great time of disaster. It was called World War II. And most of us are familiar with World War II because we know about 6 million Jews dying, and we think, what a great tragedy. So many should die. So many should pass away. Except that's just the small end of the tragedy, because it was far greater than that. There were 6 million Jews that died, but there were at least 20 million Russians who died. There were at least 40 million people who died in that war, not six, possibly as many as 60 million people. It was a great and terrible war. And the preponderant emotion during that time was fear. Can you imagine living in Europe in the middle of the 1940s, especially if you were a Jew, but just living in Europe at that time, and knowing that the chaos was just outside the door, knowing that the danger was always at a present, that it was that close, that you could die, that you could be carried away. Well, a while back I was reading a book, and there was an anonymous quote in that book from a French resistance fighter. Nobody knows who he was or anything like that. And it's translated from the French, so it's kind of a loose translation. But he said a rather wonderful thing. He said, a great evil has arisen, and night has overcome us. But we will lift up lamps of courage and go forth into the morning. I found it amazing that a man living in a place like that, with great battles all around him, knowing that he is quite likely to die within a very short period of time, in 1943, at the depths of the war, perhaps the ugliest part of the entire war, when the Allied powers were at their darkest hour, he said, I know we'll make it. And I thought about that, and I realized that he wasn't saying the lamps were courage, but the courage of the people would light a path for them that would lead them. And it's kind of a wonderful thought when you think about it. You see a large group of people walking forward with a lamp held high in a chaotic wilderness heading towards peace, heading towards freedom. It's a startling simile. And the amazing thing is, well, it's actually not too amazing. God uses the same simile. You go far back in time, the time of the Exodus, and it occurred to me a while ago that God didn't need to give the people of Israel a cloud by day to lead them through the wilderness. I mean, he could have given Moses a roadmap. It would have worked just as well. They did not need a cloud. They did not need a pillar of flame by night. They weren't going anyplace. They resided at night. Why was it there? It was a lamp of courage. Any Israelite at any time could look up, look forward and say, Emmanuel, my God is with me. And he would be heartened by that thing, and his faith would be strengthened, and he could go forth. You don't need that to travel an 11 days journey from Egypt to Israel. You need that for your heart to take a journey from darkness to light. Now, we've seen four times, the time of Moses, the time of Jeremiah, the time of Jesus, the depth of despair in World War II, and then we come to our time. There's only one problem about our time, of course. I look around me and I don't see any chaos. And this is hardly a wilderness here in Oregon. It's a beautiful, lovely, well-watered place. I know that there would be some who might dispute me and say, no, we do live in a chaotic time. All you have to do is look at what's going on in Iraq and Iran. All you have to do is look at the Middle East, look at the Southeast Asian peninsulas. All you have to do is look at Central America, look at South America. And I say, yeah, you can look at those places, but it doesn't touch me. As far as I'm concerned, I do not live in chaos. I look around me, and it's a pleasant, warm, quiet place. I'm safe and secure here. And I look up, and I remember something that happened on Monday night. I think back a couple of months, and I see Duncan reaching out and tapping John on the shoulder and saying, I'd like you to give us a talk about the signs of these things that have come upon us. And John stood up, and he lifted up his head, and he said, ah, I see signs. You've gone through your whole life living through all these things, and you look up and you see, I see signs. What got me on Monday night was that John had mentioned that he hadn't noticed up until that time, until he was asked to look, that all these things were going on, but he lifted up his head, and he noticed these things, and he saw signs. He tapped Ray on Tuesday. And Ray stood up, he lifted up his head, and Ray said, I see my vindication coming. He said, I've spent 30 years being a believer, preaching the truth, talking to people. And I see in the near future a justification for all I've been, for all I believe, for all I ever will be coming towards me right now. He tapped Ted. And Ted very generously described us as being stooped down in labor. And Ted said, he stood, and he lifted up his head, and he saw his redemption coming on the wings of the wind, on the clouds of morning. Ted was very generous. I don't see us stooping down with labor. I dare say there are not many amongst us who would say that we are overburdened by the labors of the Lord. I do not see many amongst us who would say that we are weighted down with our service to the body. You see, God created man upright, but we've sought out many devices, and we are now inclined towards evil. If there is anything that pulls us down towards the earth, it is that we have a much stronger affinity and a fascination with our earthly mother than we do with our spiritual heavenly father. We are attracted to the earth. Just as much as the gravity pulls us down, our own earthly, fleshly desires pull us downward. We are held downward by our desire to be a part of the earth. And God looks out at us, and he does not demand that we walk our entire lives upright, because he knows only one man was capable of that. But he said, he looked down and he said, when I'm about to send him back, when it's close, I'd like to see something happen. I'd like to find every one of you upright at that time. And so this week, we've seen these talks, and we realize that John looked up, and he saw. And now he's standing with his head lifted high. Ray stood up, and he lifted up his head, and he saw. And now he's standing with his head lifted high. Ted stood. He looked up. Now he stands with his head lifted high. The question remains, what did they all see? What was out there that rivets your attention, that doesn't allow you to turn aside to any other thing, and holds you fast, looking forward? What was it that took Jeremiah through? I mean, Jeremiah went from Israel, from Judah, down to Egypt, and on to his death. What gave him that hope that he saw, even though he never, ever, ever was back again in the nation of Israel? What was it that gave the apostles in the first century hope when they looked up? What was it that gave Moses, who never entered the land, hope? What led him? Turn with me to 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Second Chronicles chapter 20, verses 10 through 12. But now, here are men from Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, whose territory you would not allow Israel to invade when they came from Egypt. So they turned away from them and did not destroy them. See how they are repaying us by coming to drive us out of the possession you gave us as an inheritance? O our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power to face this vast army that is attacking us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon you. Turn to Psalm 25. Psalm 25, verses 14 and 15. The Lord confides in those who fear him. He makes his covenant known to them. My eyes are ever on the Lord, for only he will release my feet from the snare. Micah chapter 7, verses 5 through 7. Do not trust a neighbor. Put no confidence in a friend. Even with her who lies in your embrace, be careful of your words. For a son dishonors his father. A daughter rises up against her mother. A daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the members of his own household. But as for me, I watch in hope for the Lord. I wait for my God, my Savior. My God will hear me. Now, I know that in general we say we lift up our heads and we see a vision of the kingdom. I say slightly differently. We see a vision of the king. The kingdom is simply the expression in the earth of the character of the man we love. Of Jesus. It's the expression here amongst us of the character and the magnitude of God. I look out on these things and I see that, what do I desire of God? Well, what does John say? He says, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself, even as he is pure. It's the vision of him that purifies the servant. It's the ever-present image of your Lord before you, that makes you different, that makes you special, that transforms you, and makes you better than you were, makes you something other than those who refuse, than those who do not bow the knee to our Father. And when we are transformed by that relationship, what will happen in the kingdom? Well, the land around us will be transformed as well. What we look to in a kingdom is first a king who is holy and pure and just, then a people populating that world who are holy, pure, and just, and then a purified land, a planet that is cleansed, that is made better. One of the things I've often thought is that I don't really know if the turning over of the kingdom to God, the Father, will actually be any formal event. It will be the culmination of all of our work and all of our lives, and God will be all in all at that time because the earth will perfectly reflect what he is. Will there be a necessity of an event? Will there be a necessity of a transferal of power? I don't know. It's quite possible, it's not necessary. At this point, I would like to make a small confession. What I said at the beginning was not an aside. I said that life is what happens to you while you're doing other things. That was actually a major portion of what I wanted to say to you this evening. You see, I'm not the only person here in this room who is not where I expected to be at the age of 37 or 49 or 50 or however old you happen to be right now. I think all of us had other plans as young people. We had other hopes, other aspirations, other goals in life, and we've all ended up here together. What we need to understand is that while we've been busy occupying ourselves, doing those things that have gotten us to where we happen to be right now, someone else has been working on our life. Our life is being guided, directed, and carried for us in the bosom of Christ and being brought to where it has to go. I've done a lot of silly things in my life and a lot of foolish things. I've been places I shouldn't have been. I've committed sins and I've repented of them. All of those things I've done, and I've been forgiven for those things. But the important things in my life have been happening over the horizon, for I didn't know. I'm like John, looked up and said, whoa, there are things going on out there. I've looked up and I've seen it far away that God's been taking care of me. He's been bringing me exactly where he wants me to be. I thought I knew where I was going, and I was ever so far wrong. He knew. He's been carrying me there. And that's the vision that I hold before me, the knowledge that I will make it. I'm being carried where I'm supposed to go. I do these things. I live my life as best I can. But it is being carried for me. I am being born along. The vision that sustains us, yes, it's the kingdom, but only as it is embodied in its king. Only as it is embodied in righteousness, justice, and peace. If you doubt that, stop and think. Paul went through terrible, terrible times. He was martyred. Do you really think he was martyred for a vine and a fig tree? One of the most astonishing things I found, it wasn't astonishing really, it was a very obvious thing, I just never would have believed it about Paul. But I was reading once in Ephesians, and I don't know why, I never noticed it. But at the end of Ephesians chapter 6, Paul says something that astonished me when I read it. And like I said, I don't know why, I should have been aware of it all times. In verse 19, Paul says, pray also for me, that whenever I open my mouth, words may be given me, so that I will fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I'm an ambassador in chains. Pray that I may declare it fearlessly, as I should. You don't pray to be fearless unless you're terribly afraid. That, I know it's kind of, this is going to sound a little strange, but it was very heartening to me to realize that perhaps the greatest champion the truth has ever known is afraid. Just like I am. As much afraid as I am when I have to stand in front of you and speak. As much afraid as I was years ago when I had to go knocking on doors and I had trouble raising my hand because I didn't want to hit the door. And sometimes I missed. He was as much afraid as when I would sit on a street corner, afraid to go to the next door because I just couldn't face another rejection. He was afraid. Do you think he was born through that fear? By a thought of a plot of land? Or was he born through that fear by a vision of courage? By a vision of hope? By a vision of his master, his king, going through the same thing? Ever looking upwards and seeing that love and compassion being spread upon so many thousands of people and saying, it would be a shameful thing if I should not give my best in service to this man. It would be a shameful thing if I did not hope in him and trust in him and know that someday I will be transformed with him. Do you think that Moses didn't feel the same thing? And he felt too shy? I can't speak. Someone else was given for him to speak because he couldn't do it himself. He was born through that fear because he saw the vision. He said, someday there will be a prophet greater than I. And he will transform us all and make us what we need to be in order to serve our Father well. Our service to God, our path to this kingdom, begins with our King. It is guided, it is upheld, it is sustained by our King, and in the end, it will culminate in our meeting with our King. With that in mind, the perfect description of the kingdom should be just like this. See, a king will reign in righteousness, and rulers will rule with justice. Each man will be like a shelter from the wind and a refuge from the storm, like streams of water in the desert and the shadow of a great rock in a thirsty land. Then the eyes of those who see will no longer be closed, and the ears of those who hear will listen. The mind of the rash will know and understand, and the stammering tongue will be fluent and clear. No longer will the fool be called noble, nor the scoundrel be highly respected, for the fool speaks folly, his mind is busy with evil. He practices ungodliness and spreads error concerning the Lord. The hungry he leaves empty, and from the thirsty he withholds water. The scoundrel's methods are wicked. He makes up evil schemes to destroy the poor with lies, even when the plea of the needy is just. But the noble man makes noble plans, and by noble deeds he stands. Justice will dwell in the desert. Righteousness live in the fertile field. The fruit of righteousness will be peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever. My people will live in peaceful dwelling places, in secure homes, in undisturbed places of rest.